In the culture war, there are no winners, just podcasters. Only a few are willing to risk their lives in the face of some of the dumbest ideas to have ever captured human civilization. Every week, we, Megan Dom and Sarah Hayter, humbly accept this mission to bring you conversations that are equal parts stunning, brave, and tormented. Welcome to a special place in hell. Sarah, you and I have an amazing guest this week. Mm-hmm. Larissa Phillips. Welcome, Larissa. Larissa is a writer, an author, and recently the author of an incredible essay that appeared in Quillette. So we're going to talk with her about it. Thanks for coming on.
Thank you so much for having me.
So this is a piece that you wrote in response to a relatively recent essay that had been in the journal Liberties. It was written by Celeste Marcus. And actually, Sarah, I don't think you and I talked about this piece, did we?
We didn't talk about it. We talked about talking about it.
Right.
And then decided against it for some reason.
We talk about talking about a lot of things and then think better of it. But I'm glad we're getting to talk about it in this context. So this was a piece in Liberties, published a couple of months ago, called After a Rape, a Guide for the Tormented. And we can go into the details of that, but suffice it to say that, Larissa, you wrote a response to this piece. So why don't we start by talking about why you wrote the response, and then obviously that will, from there, you can tell us your story, as well as the story of the piece.
Okay. Well, the story, the original situation was that Celeste Marcus wrote a long essay detailing a rape and how to deal with a rape and like the after effects of a rape. And then shortly afterwards, she didn't name who the rapist was, the alleged rapist. And then shortly after, she posted on Twitter that she had contacted the Atlantic Monthly, letting them know that they had a rapist among their writers, and they severed ties with him.
Yeah.
You know, summarily, you know, which is strange, you know, like so that bothers me. And that's something that's been bothering me for a long time, is the lack of due process around rape, starting with in 1991, when I was in college and there was a guy who was kicked off campus for rape. And I remember being like, wait, was there a trial or a hearing? And there wasn't one. Mm-hmm. And I didn't understand how that could happen. And yeah.
Yeah.
So that was the first issue, was just like the lack of due process, which is really bothering me.
Yeah, I know. So that's interesting. So Larissa and I were in college around the same time, and we can maybe in a little bit, we can sort of talk about everything that's transpired since then. I mean, these were the days of the Take Back the Night marches and all that kind of thing. But we should say, so in Celeste's piece, which appeared in Liberties, which is a journal published by Leon Wieseltier, formerly of the New Republic, who was himself Me Too'd out of sort of mainstream publishing and started his own journal with Celeste, by the way. So they were sort of business partners. Celeste is very young. I think she's in her early 20s or mid 20s, maybe now. Maybe, I don't know, in her 20s. And I mean, the thing about that piece, and we can talk about the substance of it, but really we want to talk about your piece, Larissa, is that she wrote it about this thing that had happened. And it's very abstract. The piece is composed in such a way that we're not entirely sure what happened, because it seems like maybe the narrator is not sure what happened. She didn't mention the quote unquote rapist in the piece, but she did, you know, it was published. It sat there for maybe a month or so. And then apparently she emailed the editor of The Atlantic saying, one of your contributing writers is in fact the rapist. The editor wrote back and said, probably something that was an ill-advised sort of, we're sorry that happened to you kind of thing. We take this very seriously. And that was that. She later screenshot that email correspondence and tweeted it, and thereby revealing the name of the person who had raped her, allegedly. So that's how that went down. And you wrote your piece incredibly quickly, we should say. I mean, it's a magnificent piece of writing. And it details...
I wrote a piece really quickly. The piece I submitted to Quillette, I wrote like one of those moments where you just are like, just flows. You know, you're just like, I got something to say. I'm going to say it. It's on paper now. And it was really easy. And then I sent it to Quillette and they accepted it. And then kind of like right at the last minute, the editor was like, would you consider restructuring this? And then we spent a month working on it.
Oh, okay. Okay. So, I mean, we should say you were raped really brutally and violently by two men in Italy when you were a student.
I wasn't a student. I was done with college.
Oh, you were done with college. Okay. You were a very young person traveling around. So you were in your early 20s.
Yeah.
Okay. And so you talk about this in the piece. It was published in Quillette. So initially, did you have any plans to write about your exact story? Or was originally you were just sort of responding to the way Celeste had presented her story?
There were elements of my story in the original piece, like quite a bit, because that was kind of, I kind of mirrored her essay. You know, I was like, here's an alternate version of, you know, 30 years after a rape, you know, how it looks. And so I really like mirrored her essay and I used a lot of my story, but I think that one of the issues was that it was too confusing. My story is so complicated. Like there's so many elements to it. So the editor, Jamie Palmer, was like, he really encouraged me to sort of like tell it in more detail.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Well, I wasn't confused reading it. The process worked because I felt like it was, I didn't even realize how long it was until.
It's really long.
Yeah, I like sent it to someone else and then they were like, wait, this is really long.
Oh my God, coming from Sarah, that's huge because everything is too long for her.
Well, this was an easy read and I understood what was happening, especially in the part of it where you're describing the attack and what transpired afterwards. It could have been very confusing. It was not. And I feel like I understood what had happened with a kind of clarity that I did not get in the original essay that that prompted you to write this, which was a very frustrating read. I had a polar opposite reaction, not only because of the political message, which was different, but just the writing style, I suppose, or maybe we're talking about quality. I'm not sure. I'm not the writer here, so I don't know what exactly was so frustrating about it, but I did feel as if.
I thought it was a little coy, you know, it didn't tell
the first piece. Yeah. Well, I mean, Larissa had specific details and facts. That goes a long way.
It was as if she was trying to be more poetic almost, you know, and like trying to evoke all these emotions in us that did not feel earned, I guess. And I think that that's a really rough thing to say, given that what she's talking about is an alleged rape. But that is how I felt. I kind of felt as if I was being manipulated throughout her piece, but I did not feel that way with yours at all, which was...
Well, Larissa, can you just give us a kind of thumbnail sketch of your story? I mean, obviously, we're not going to be able to do it justice in this conversation, but just so people have an idea of what we're talking about.
Yeah, sure. So I was living in Italy. I was in my early 20s. And on one evening in January of 1993, I walked home from a movie. I went to a movie by myself. I walked home. I stopped at the bar where my boyfriend worked. He was busy. So I decided I was going to walk home. I was going to take the bus. I missed the bus. So I walked home. And as I was passing a park in a safe city, well-lit sidewalks, everything, I was accosted by two men. They, you know, just sort of like descended upon me, pulled me to the park. And I resisted, which caused me to get beaten up pretty badly. And ultimately, two against one, it's not really a fair fight. So I succumbed and was raped by both of them. And they took my jewelry, they took my money, and they left. And then the rest of the story, and kind of like the salient part of the story for me was what happened afterwards, which was, you know, the sort of like journey, not only back to my apartment first and like through the police and the hospital, but just kind of ultimately coming back to being a fully inhabited self.
And you actually, they end up getting caught because they've been totally doing crazy. This routinely. I mean, they are serial rapists.
They had done it one other time, at least that we know of. That was actually a really interesting part of the editing process because we vetted everything. Like obviously, you know, everything had to be vetted and, the editor was like, there cannot be a single word that is like not verify that we haven't. So we were like translating police documents and court documents and newspapers. And I was like looking through my journals that I hadn't looked at in decades. You know, it was really wild, like trying to find things. And so right away, there was this one issue where I had always thought that my yelling, because I was really loud, that's why I got beaten up so much, I wouldn't stop yelling. And someone had told me that my yelling had prompted somebody to call the police. And that then the police had arrived right as my rapists were leaving the park, and that that had caused the high-speed car chase. And that was why they crashed. And that was why they were then apprehended and brought into the same hospital where I was. So I spent like 30 years feeling like sort of heroic about that. I was like, yeah, you know, that was because I, you know, I was really proactive and it caused the police to come. And right away, the editor, Jamie, he gets a newspaper article translated, and he's like, no, it says in here that it was a totally random traffic stop, like many, many blocks away. Mm-hmm. And it was because they were driving erratically. And I was like, how, that's crazy. How could I, there's no way I made that up. And so I was like looking through my journals and I did finally find where the lawyer had told me that in like months later, like in May, she told me that. So we still like couldn't really verify that that was exactly like that was the catalyst, that my yelling was the catalyst for the police coming and resulting in the apprehension. But yeah, it was just interesting. Like it was and like so many aspects were like that, just like digging. It was like crime reporting almost.
Mm-hmm. So this happened to you. You endure this event. You end up going back to your apartment. Can you sort of take us through the timeline a little bit? Like you're deciding to go to a hospital. Like how did that all go down?
Yeah, because that was like kind of one of the cruxes of the whole issue for me and how I looked back on this. So I walk back home and I don't have a phone in my apartment. So I have to call from the phone booth. So I call my boyfriend. He's like, go get in the apartment, you know, lock the door. And so I go home and I'm all like, I'm super messed up. Like I look like Freddy Krueger, like really, really bad, badly beaten up. And my boyfriend arrives and he's cleans my face. He's very sweet and furious. And he's like, we have to go to the police. And I'm like a feminist. And I know all about rape and like how rape is prosecuted. And I'm like, you don't understand. I'm going to get raped all over by the police it's not going to work. And even if there was a trial, like they're going to examine my sexual history. Like I was just like, there's no way I can go, which was a really ironic thing for how the fact that I was that educated about feminism and about rape, I was like, well, I can't, there's no way I can.
Right. And we should say this is in Italy and this is your boyfriend is Italian.
He's Italian. Yeah. And so I'm like, I know what it's like in the US. It's going to be even worse here. There's no way. And in fact, it is difficult in Italy often, as it is often here, you know, but my boyfriend didn't know about the patriarchy, as you know, as I said in the article. So he was like, no, we're going to the police. And like, we argued about it and he won because I was not really in a position to argue. And just because I was so like exhausted and scared and, you know, in shock. And so I was like, okay, fine. And so we go to we go out to the curb to call the police and a police car is going by randomly, like, you know, and where he's like, oh, and he flags it down and it's three policemen in there and we tell them what happened and they're like, get in. And it turns out they were on their way to the scene of the accident where these two men who matched my description had crashed a stolen car. So they were like, oh, get in. You know, so then we, let's see.
But wait, so did they take you to the hospital? Because so they did not proceed to the crime scene. So hopefully
I had told them that there had been a knife because during the assault, one of the men kept pressing something to my throat and saying it was a knife. I don't know if it was a knife, but he said it was a knife. And so when I told them that, they wanted to go find the knife. So we went, this didn't make it into the essay. First, we went back to the park and we spent like 20 minutes, half an hour looking for the knife. Wow. And then I got really dizzy and I kind of like sat down on the ground and they were like, everyone was like, oh shit, we got to get her to the hospital. So they took me to the hospital. And then, as I said in the article, like here, all the predictions came true because it was ridiculous. Like there was no rape kit. There were no women doctors. There was no private room. You know, so I was in like this sort of main area of the emergency room with this team of men like really like handsome doctors, like these young like soap opera type of doctors, and like I think like residents or like, you know, student doctors, and this one old man, and they're like helping me undress. It was really wild, and it honestly was not traumatic. Like I kept just thinking to myself, you're not doing this right. This is not how you're supposed to do it. But they were honestly like they were kind. You know, there wasn't like I think that was just the underlying feel. Like I could tell that they were just awkward. They didn't know what to do. So they were trying, and they were just so like these young men who were like taking my pants from me and like unlacing my boots and like helping me pull my boots off. It wasn't malicious, you know, or oppressive. It was just awkward. They were just so awkward. And so at that point I was just like, you're not supposed to do it this way. So I tell them my story, and my boyfriend runs off to go, there's something going on, and he comes running back and he's like, they're here.
There's something going on in the hospital down.
Yeah,
the
like
hall,
outside of
mean?
The door. Yeah, like out on the other side of some door. There's all this stuff going on. So he runs off to see what it is, and he comes back. He's like, they have them. They got them. They're on the other side of that door. And I was like, I had just finished getting dressed, so I was like, you know, like freaked out a little bit, like kind of like jumped back, like what, you know? And he was like, no, they're more dead than alive. It's fine. And I was like, how do you know it's them? And he pulled out my jewelry that the police had given back to him. And so that was like kind of wild. And then you want me to keep going?
Please.
Okay. So we were waiting for a gynecologist to do a pelvic exam. And I had taken a shower, and I was like, you're not going to find anything. And I took a shower. And so they finally found a gynecologist, and they were like, let's go. We're going to go do the visit. And I just like hit my wall, and I was like, I can't do that. Like, it's just not possible for me to do that. I'm not undressing. I'm not opening my legs again. And I was also kind of, this was something also that I held for 30 years. I believed this. They said, this is all in Italian, and they're like, it's time for you to be visited. It's time for the visit. And I was like, ew. Like, I thought it was like some cute, sexy name for like the pelvic exam that the Italians do. And I was just disgusted. And I was just like, I don't know if that was part of it, but I was just like, or whatever. I was just like at the end of my rope. I was like, I can't do that. And I'm sorry. I just can't. And I just kept saying no. There's just no way for me to get past that. And the nurses were getting really mad at me. Like everyone was crowded around me, kind of like sort of like telling me that I had to do it. I was going to wreck the investigation. And Enzo, my boyfriend, who was just like fantastic, lovely, lovely person, took my hand and like looked into my eyes, and he was like, I'll go with you and I will hold your hand the whole time. And that was literally the only way that I could do it. And the nurses were irritated and kind of like rolled their eyes. And, but it was great. You know, it was beautiful. I was happy that I could give him his due in this article, because he was really like a wonderful person and very instrumental in so many positive things coming out of it. So I did the pelvic exam, and then we went to the police station. We filed the report. And then we finally came back home at like 6:30 in the morning.
And so what happened in terms of prosecuting these guys?
So yeah, that was interesting, because it was Italy. And Italy at the time, I don't know what it's like now, but everything was I would get like a note. Like there'd be like a special delivery. I'd get like a notice, and the notice would say that I had to go to the post office to get something delivered on some certain day. So I would go on a certain day, and I would get this missive saying that I was going to get a delivery at my apartment on another day. Like it was a lot like that, you know, like super bureaucratic and like torturous and crazy. But I did the identification. I got called to do the identification. And while I was there, I met by accident, I was left in the same room with a young woman, Italian woman, and we started chatting. We weren't supposed to have any contact with each other. And we realized we were there for the same purpose, because she had been raped. She had been assaulted a couple nights before by the same guys. And we were there to identify the same ones. And we exchanged our phone numbers really quickly. And then the guards or the lawyers or somebody came in and was like, you can't be with each other. And like just in time, we exchanged numbers, which was amazing. And we became friends. She was great. So she got a lawyer, this like feminist, Italian feminist lawyer, about a scar like all the way down her face, which was very interesting. And she was pretty intimidating. And we got her very last minute. She didn't think we were going to win. And we got no lawyer. So this is actually really interesting. I actually just found this out, that in Italy, until the mid-90s, there was a law about rape that had been created by Mussolini that said that rape was a moral crime against society.
Mm.
And so it was kind of like we were just incidental to the process, because it wasn't that we had been violated, it was that society had been violated. So we were like witnesses to a crime against society.
Huh. And is that like prosecuted differently, like in terms of it's worse if you do it to society or to an individual?
I don't know, but it got overturned in the mid-90s. Like they'd been trying to I assume feminists have been trying to overturn it for a long time, and they changed it to a crime against an individual.
Mm.
And that any part of the body could be violated.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought that was so interesting, because I thought we would get lawyers too, and we weren't assigned lawyers, and they were assigned the assailants were assigned lawyers, and we were just witnesses. It wasn't about us, you know. And so that this other woman got a lawyer was proactive and, you know, outside of the norm.
Mm.
And she helped us, and go ahead.
Oh, no, I was going to say, presumably. So she was Italian. You were the only foreigner in this mix.
Yeah, I was so scared to testify, because I thought I was going to have to testify up until the last minute. And I was like, should I testify in Italian or in English with a translator?
Yeah, like, I was going to say, how good was your Italian throughout all of this? Because I'm imagining you're speaking Italian and so are they.
Yeah, it was all in Italian. My Italian was pretty good. I would go days without speaking English. But the law stuff was crazy, because I don't know a lot of the law lawyerly terms, you know, and she talked really fast. So I would be like, uh-huh. Like I'd be like really focusing and like thinking I understood. And then I would leave and be like, wait a minute, what did she say? You know? And the other thing that happened was in the police station, in the whole first night, like I didn't know the vocabulary for violence. You know, I just didn't, it wasn't like like a pack of vocabulary words that I'd ever encountered. So I was always like kind of saying like, and then he hit me, but strongly, you know, like sort of modifying like these words that I did know.
Mm-hmm.
So mm-hmm. What do we end up knowing about these perpetrators? Like, who were they?
Oh yeah, that's interesting. So they were Moroccan, and they were undocumented. I don't know anything about them really. They were in the early 20s. But the one thing that I do know that didn't make it into the article, because it was not on the timeline, but about like, I think it was like in April. So the assault was in late January and the trial was in late May. And in April, this woman came to my house and started yelling my name. Like I had a second floor apartment. And I leaned out my window, and it was this Moroccan woman. And she said, you know, I want to talk to you about what happened in January. So I went down and talked to her, and she said she was a cousin of one of them, and that she wanted to tell me not to testify. And she was like begging me not to testify. She said their kids were going to go hungry if I testified.
Wow.
Which was wild.
So they had, yeah. I mean, they were pretty young, and
probably married.
And those guys had.
Apparently, you know, with children. It did, you know, in retrospect, it did kind of remembering that made me like it sort of soothed my sort of it occurred to me, like, what if I did, you know, after the Alice Siebold who wrote that one about rape, and then it turned out she convicted the wrong guy, and that actually occurred to me, and then I was like, wait a minute, that, like, reading my journals and reading about this incident, I was like, no, she was very clear that they had done it, but they were still good boys,
right?
You know, they hadn't meant it, they were drunk.
Wow. So did they end?
I had actually already grappled with that. Like, once I got past the idea of, you know, that I was going to testify or that I was going to participate in the prosecution as much as I could, I started thinking about the racism of the courts, you know, and I was totally aware of the fact that I'm a white American. The other woman was a Italian. And then here were these Moroccan men. And of course the courts were going to side with us, you know, like, and I was super leftist. Like, I was completely passionate about all this stuff. I mean, you see this in the news sometimes, like women who won't testify when, like, their boyfriend gets murdered, or they're, you know, like, there are these cases, and I don't feel that way anymore, but I remember feeling that way and really feeling like I shouldn't participate in this. But I went through a whole thought process where I was just like, you know, it's not rocket science to know that you're not supposed to rape people, you know, like,
right.
And so I can't be responsible for the consequences that come to someone who's taken that path. I don't know. And as it turned out, it wouldn't have mattered anyway. The lawyer told me I would have been subpoenaed. So it wasn't even my choice.
Mm-hmm. Did they go to prison?
Yeah, they got 8 years conviction each, okay. Which was totally wild. And I think it was because there were two of us. And just that it was the fact that they had my jewelry and my money, you know, the exact things I had described. Like, it was just very clear. And there was two of us. And they'd stolen a car, and they'd also assaulted a police officer.
Well, there you go. I mean, there's a lot going on there.
There's a lot. Yeah.
Yeah. And you were, I think I misspoke earlier. You were not traveling. You were living there. You had an apartment. You were living in Italy. Did you, first of all, was this a media story? Like, were you sort of becoming a public figure around this time?
It wasn't.
Was your identity known?
No. They never said I was a studentessa USA in the headlines. It was in a bunch of the papers, and I went around like a few weeks later with my boyfriend and got copies of some of the newspaper articles just because I felt kind of compelled to keep them, which I'm glad I did now. It wasn't a huge thing, but it was in the paper for a few days.
Wow. Okay. Wow.
What Sarah, was it like remembering all this, going through? I mean, do you feel like you went through it again as you were compiling all this information? And
I can't stress enough how completely I resolved this trauma. Like, it's not. In fact, the thing that I loved so much about working with this editor was that he was so clinical, and there was this was not therapy. And it never felt like therapy, and I never wanted it to be therapy, and he didn't treat it like therapy. It was just when we would have these discussions about word choice around the rape paragraph, and it was just a totally, it was about the essay. It was about writing a good essay and not therapy. And I've been kind of interested in seeing how much the reaction that I've gotten as I've told friends before the article came out, especially, kind of oh, that's going to be so great to get it out. And I'm like, I got it out a long time ago, and I went on with my life, and it's not like a secret thing in my brain that I stumbled upon and kind of rediscovered. I did the work, I guess, at the time I worked really, really hard at the time to do whatever my feeling was okay, I lost that half hour, whatever it was, I had no control over my life during that half hour, whatever amount of time it was. Those two men owned my life and controlled it. And then the next, the rest of that night, I didn't have a lot of control over it. And going forward, I'm going to have, what am I going to do? Let them still keep it? It just was so clear. What do I need to do? They can't have it. They can't have the rest of my life. Yeah. So it was a question of if it was what do I need to do to get my whole self back? And I did that. I actually created a little bit of a program for myself, and I followed it. Cause there was no, it was so frustrating because there was no script. I had to figure it out myself, because everything, it was lovely how people would tell me I was brave and whatever. And it was very sweet, and I always appreciated that. But there was no, there was no path. And I kind of feel it's kind of what I wanted to say in the article too, because I think there's still no path. There's still, fine. Some people are going to deal with trauma however they want it, they're going to deal with it. But here's this other option. I can present this other option, which is that you actually can, I don't know, I could anyway, get completely do the work and get over trauma and go on with your life. I don't know. It's an option. Maybe some other people might want to see that option.
How did you, did you go to therapy? I mean, we have to remember this was the mid 90s at this point. What year is this? 93. Okay. So, I think this would be very interesting for people who are not from that time. It was not you were sent to counseling, or it's not you were immediately sort of deposited into this trauma recovery.
No. And
world.
And even more so at that time, none of us knew anyone who'd been raped. I was the first person anybody knew who had been raped. Maybe people had been raped, but you didn't know it. Nobody knew anyone who had been raped.
Even in college, date rape. That whole conversation going on.
Yeah, there was that. But nobody knew anyone who'd been violently raped by a stranger.
Right. Right.
You know, and I didn't, I knew a few people who'd been date raped, but not like, you know what I mean? Like not like the ambiguous cases.
Yeah.
Right.
Like everyone was drunk, you know, and like that kind of thing. Anyway. So, yeah, so none of us knew anyone, and I knew about, my mom's a therapist. Like I knew about therapy, but, I'm not like a huge fan of therapy, and I went to a therapist, and, she was nice, and she kept telling me how brave I was. And I was like, that's not, I don't need that. That's not what I'm looking for. And so I didn't go back, and just, I don't know. It just seemed like there were more active things that I could do, you know? So do you want to, can I tell you about my program?
Yeah. I was going to ask.
So I had this, this plan, I came up with this plan, and one of the things was I had this image of like a mass of like, I was in a lot of pain, you know, I was definitely like really, suffering, and it like to be that degraded, it's hard to come back from that. Like, it's just so shocking to have been treated, to have been so degraded, and it was painful. And, so I had this sort of vision of like a, almost like a tumor within me. Like I kind of separated the pain from myself, that I had this like sort of tumor inside of myself that was the pain. And I had this idea that I had to just like chip away at it to get it out. And I decided that the ways to do that had a lot to do with exhaling. So talking was really good. Anytime I could talk, anytime anybody wanted to talk about it, I wanted to talk and tell them about it. Exercising I thought was really good, like breathing out. I just had this vision of like breathing out. Like every time I breathed out, there was another little piece of the pain coming out. I thought crying was really good. So anytime I had like a cry coming on, I would prioritize that. I would go to work late if I was going to like sob, like have a good cry. And then I thought laughing was really good. Like laughing was like amazing. And my best friend who I shared, who was my roommate, was one of those really, really funny people. And like, she's just very funny. And I remember like maybe 2 days, I think it was really like 2 days after the rape, she made a joke about the rape and then like looked at me like totally stricken. Like, was it too soon?
Oh my God.
No. And that was
one of the days.
I know. And it wasn't.
Oh my God.
It was like amazing. It was like, you know, like after 9/11, the first time you could really laugh, you know, or after a funeral or something, it was just like so cathartic and amazing. And so laughing, I felt like was really, really important. And I thought smoking was really bad, and I love smoking, but I can't smoke because I like smoking too much. And when my boyfriend showed up in my apartment that night, he handed me a cigarette, like typical Italian, you know, like, here you go. And I was like, oh yeah, smoking is good. So I was always trying to quit smoking, you know, once I kind of got past that immediate crisis. And, so that was one part. And then I also had this idea that I needed to, think of like just the whole shame thing, you know, like I was like, I'm not going to do that. I didn't do this. I didn't do anything wrong. Mm-hmm. So I didn't, but I had to work at that to like really keep that sort of thought really clear in my mind that like hadn't done anything wrong. So, I had this idea that it was a car accident, or I had that as a standard. I was like, okay, so imagine if you'd gotten mowed down by a car, you had to go to the emergency room. That's what happened. So anytime I was in a weird situation, I'd be like, what would you do if this was a car accident? How would you talk about this? Or how would you think about this? So for example, like maybe 10 days after the rape, I ran into a girl that I kind of knew, like an acquaintance. And I was like, I probably still had like a little bit of bruising, but I could have gotten away with it with not telling her. And I was thinking, so I was like, what would I tell her? Would I tell her about a car accident that landed me in the emergency room? And I was like, yeah, I would. That was 10 days ago or a week ago or whatever. I'm going to tell her. So I told her, and it was really awkward. And I was like, you know, like breathing hard as I told her, and she was totally awkward. But I was just like, that's what I have to do. Like, it has to be that. So I always held that as a standard. Mm.
How did you feel about the evolving conversation then over the next couple of decades around feminism, abuse, trauma, sexual assault, due process? Katie Royfe's book came out in 1993, which you reference. I mean, it's funny. So you go back and read that book now, it's so anodyne. It was called The Morning After. It had to do with the sort of culture around Take Back the Night, you know, college camp rape hysteria. I don't even think she used the word hysteria, if she did, not frequently. but it was a huge stir. Katie Royfe became a pariah, sort of the original thought criminal. But and the conversation, what's that?
It just got worse since then.
Like, yeah, So as the 90s progressed, this was more and more in the air. Then you get into the 2000s, you know, fast forward all the way to Me Too. I mean, what kind of person were you like in the world as a woman, as a feminist, as a writer, as a person just sort of thinking about these things and talking about these things? Where were you at politically and otherwise?
I'm from like a super leftist background and like really, really left, and always felt very leftist, not even liberal. You know, liberal was a bad word. I was a leftist. And I have had just like so many moments that have caused me to lapse in my faith in a lot of progressive politics. That is just, you know, it's that sort of slowly and then all at once kind of conversion. So I'm pretty frustrated with the left these days. Around a lot of these issues, the trigger warnings thing, made me insane. That's just so wrong. Like, that made me crazy. I was like, okay, so you've had some kind of assault or trauma, and now you're not allowed to read literature. Like, you know, like that was always the biggest fear to me, was that I was going to be an invalid, that I was going to be some kind of like emotional invalid who had to be protected and like treated like a child. So I didn't understand that at all. And plus, trauma and PTSD, I don't know. Somebody just asked me recently if I still had PTSD. And I was like, I never had PTSD. PTSD is a disorder. Like, I had a normal kind of recovery that is difficult and painful and a lot of crying, some panic attacks, whatever. And then I got better. Like, just PTSD.
They would say actually that your recovery was abnormal given the way that it proceeded and given like how we now think of as what rape is and what it does to you. It's as if it's a wound that can never heal. And like, now you're transformed into another kind of person.
Or you must not have been healing properly.
And that is what, say. I mean, that's what the other essay, I don't want to trash the other essay too much, but it was that was how she was framing it, as if, after rape, now you're just shattered and maybe you'll come together. And maybe,
right.
You know,
the raped. I mean, she talked. Yeah. I mean, the raped became a category of person to be in.
Yeah. It's unfortunate. Like I said, I'm offering a different model.
Yeah.
Which is not to say that it's not hard. I mean, it was difficult, but I hated all of the discourse that sort of kept unraveling and accelerating around trigger warning, safe spaces, around consent, the whole consent thing. I think that's, I don't understand it, actually. I don't understand. Yeah. This is like we have all the sexual freedom, you know, like tons of sexual freedom, like more than has ever been, you know, happened in the history of the world, probably, or for many, many centuries. And so in order to regulate it, we're going to have this verbal contract that, and if the verbal contract is violated, there can be like unbelievable consequences. Like a boy especially can be kicked out of college or lose a scholarship or lose his job or whatever. But like, what are the, like, so you give consent every step of the way? Like, when do you stop giving consent? Like, you, like, because my understanding is even after penetration, you still have to give consent.
Yeah, every
to time. Orgasm,
every thrust, you have to give consent.
Yes,
yeah.
You cannot come unless you actually give consent.
It's like, who came up with these ideas? These are terrible ideas, and it's a flimsy contract. It's like, if you want a contract, it's not a good contract. You know,
were you talking about this stuff with people over the years? Your other leftist friends,
if they didn't get mad at me, yeah. everyone in. You know how it is.
People. Yeah. But I mean,
I have a lot of friends and family who are mad at me about a lot of things.
Okay. I mean,
not because great. I have like special privileges, you know, like.
Right. I'm yes. You have standing. Yes. Yeah. You have the standpoint epistemology stands up for you. Well, so, I mean, because, you know, one of the things that I've thought about a lot and written about a lot is the way I think our generation really valued resilience and toughness, and maybe overly so. Like, you know, and I know you've written about this, your parents divorced when you were young. There was kind of chaos with, like, you know, your parents, you know, then dating other people and bringing them around. And like, that was the kind of Gen X tableau in a way, not for everybody, but that, you know, that was definitely happening.
Yeah.
And I sometimes wonder if we sort of fetishize toughness in a way. And as I've had a lot of people also push back and say, like, well, also part of the reason you're not, you, part of the reason you think consent is silly and all these things are silly is because you just have a particular kind of temperament. And just because you are kind of a tough natured person, or a little bit aloof, or a little bit indifferent, or whatever it is, doesn't mean that other people are. So you're imposing your own temperament onto other people, and that you're sort of inflicting your own privilege, your resilience privilege onto them. And, you know, I don't know if you have thoughts about that. I mean, I think there's maybe some validity to that, actually. I've had to think about it, but it's a little bit counterproductive in terms of living a good life in society.
I mean, if somebody is not, has no resilience, or is so timid, I don't know if consent, verbal consent, is going to take care of that.
Yeah. But,
like, I don't know if that's a good solution. I mean, I don't know what the solution is for the sexual freedom that we have, how you're going to regulate and protect people, because it is, it's hard to control, and it's hard to control outcomes. And I don't know what the answer is, but I just think verbal consent, even if whether you're resilient or not resilient, I think it's a terrible.
Yeah, it's a terrible model. Practice. It's a terrible way. And how would it, there's just no way for it to for us to have that, the kind of freedom that we have. And then at the same time say, but though some people are so, you know,
fragile,
so vulnerable and fragile.
Right.
And we can't change it. Well, then they should just be protected and, you know, have arranged marriages.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, and that's
right.
That's,
you need burkas or you need enforced marriage.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, but that's how really, really conservative cultures, like the one that I come from, like that's how they think about it. I mean, not in this psychological mental health therapy sense, but they come to the same conclusion, which is that women are fragile and need to be protected. And we're like dumb, like we make bad decisions that we later come to regret. And so the adult males around us have to make these important decisions for us to protect us, you know, and it's it's always sold as this is for you. We're doing this for you.
Yeah.
And it's really sad to see some of this language creep back in without any kind of, you know, like at the same time, there aren't guides like the one, like the program that you created for yourself about, well, how to recover, how to actually just get over it and be a normal human again and have kind of a healthy relationship with your past to the extent that you can have it. It's just not enough. There's no guides. And if anything, it's, you know, I have trouble discussing my past, not to say that I have like the kind of experiences that you have, but I have some experiences that, you know, might shock people, but I don't like to talk about it because then there's the label. And like in your case, it's rape and, you know, rape victim. And once that's there, it feels as if now others are imposing upon me an understanding of my own past, you know, and they are telling me who I am and what motivates like my current behavior, you know? So if I say that I have, you know, such and such kind of relationship with my mom or my dad or whatever, or something happened when I was six and it wasn't there, then there's this, well, this explains why you do X or Y or Z. And then I think, no, I didn't say that. And I don't like that you presume it, you know? And it just feels as if we're all therapists, you know, we're all just, but the worst psychoanalysts alive. And we're, you know, digging through even other people's pasts as a way of understanding them and not listening enough to the things that they are actually saying. Mm-hmm. And so it frustrates me so much that there are some things that, you know, are harmful things that happen that I, in another scenario, would find beneficial to talk about in that, you know, I could help others or whatever, but then I don't want to, because then I don't want to be a person to whom something like that happened, you know? My question, which this was leading up to a question, I'm sorry. We shouldn't do this so much. We should just like have like a limit on how long I can talk. But I'm wondering, do you still talk about it like in that sense, in that you know, you told your friends immediately after it happened that this serious thing happened to me. Is it still something you're talking about now? Do you hesitate to talk about it, or are you more willing to talk about it given the changes in how we think about rape?
When it first happened, I told everybody, and I would meet new friends and I would have to tell them it was something people had to know about me. And, you know, and then that sort of started creeping away where I would know somebody for longer and longer. And then it was like kind of only close friends. And then it just kind of at some point, I mean, I had kids, you know, like once I was a mother, it was just not a priority, you know, mm-hmm. It just wasn't something that I told a few friends here and there, but yeah, it wasn't something that I talked about. And I even had friends when the essay was coming out, I had a lot of friends that I was like, I have to tell you this thing about me that you don't know. And I wrote this essay because a lot of people had no idea. It wasn't something I've talked about almost at all mm-hmm. for a very long time. Mm-hmm. Like it just wasn't necessary to talk about. If it came up, I would talk about it, but you know, it wasn't like I was not talking about it. It just wasn't important to talk about. It wasn't the most important thing about me.
Mm-hmm. Are your kids in their early 20s now, or are they teenagers?
My daughter's 20 and my son is 24.
So How did they grow up around this stuff? I mean, what do you see in them and in their educations that might give us some clues as to why things have emerged the way they have?
Around like the resilience kind of thing?
Yeah, any of this. I mean, or what are they? Did they read your piece? And were they like, oh my God, how could you have this reaction?
The hardest thing about this piece was I had to tell my daughter mm-hmm. about the rape, and mm-hmm. I had never told her. She's 20. And I had tried, once she got to be like around 16, I was like, I got to tell her. And it's a terrible conversation to have with your daughter, you know? So I finally told her a couple of weeks ago, and I thought, I was like, maybe she knows, you know, she might've had an inkling. She had no idea, but she's amazing and lovely. And my son already knew because he'd overheard my mother talking about it at some point. he's 24. He suffers from a lot of this sort of stuff that boys or young males are suffering from. He's had like really rough teenage and early adult years. And he and I have had a lot of conversations about kind of coming back from dark places where I've never told him like graphic details, but I've talked a lot about just kind of that process of healing. And we've had a lot of conversations like that. My kids are a little different maybe than what you hear about Gen Z, because when in 2010, we moved from Brooklyn upstate. Mm. So they were largely raised in like a red rural area. And and my daughter in particular is like kind of amazing because she has friends from both sides of the political spectrum. And she would have parties when she, like after COVID, even like towards the end of COVID, she would have some parties where she would be introducing these like Bard high school. She did like the Bard early college thing, Bard high school kids and like her local friends. And she'd be like introducing them and like worried that about language that was going to creep up. And, you know, like, I just thought that was amazing. I loved that. So they're pretty tough and normal, and they're not woke. They're kind of disinterested. Like actually, like when Trump got elected, I was trying to get both of them to like understand how like devastating and important this was, and they did not care. And I think it's partly because my husband and I like kind of nonstop talk about politics, and they're just like, can you? I remember my daughter being like, I know, it's unprecedented. I know. Are you going to stop talking soon? You know, like they just had no interest.
How did the conversation go with your daughter about what mm-hmm. happened? I mean, how long did it last? And was it emotional? Like how much detail did you get into?
It was like a week or so before the essay was going to be finished. And she goes to college, and she happened to be, she was like, I'm coming home for lunch. You know, she goes to college an hour away. And so she came by, and I was like, okay, I'm going to do it. I got to do it. So I was like, I have to tell you something. And And so I was like, it's not bad. It's not about you. It's about me. And, you know, do you know about what happened to me in my early 20s? And I was totally expecting her to be like, yeah. And she was like, no. And I was like, okay. So I was, you know, when I was living in Italy, and she and I went to Italy several years ago and visited my friend who still lives there, my roommate from the time. And I was like, you know, when I was living with Blake in Italy and I was walking home from a movie and I got attacked and I was beaten up pretty badly and I was raped by both men. And she got tears in her eyes and kind of listened to the whole thing. And I was like, and then this is what I did afterwards. And now I'm writing this essay. You know, I didn't tell her like really graphic details, but just the outline. I didn't want to be like secretive. And mm-hmm. and I told her about the essay and what the essay was going to be about. And I said, you know, this isn't a secret. I have no like, if you ever want to ask more, or if you don't want to ask more, anything is fine. Like I this is not like a precious secret or painful thing for me. Like, you know, you're always welcome to talk about it or not talk about it. And when the essay comes out, you can read it or you cannot read it. It's totally up to you. And she, you know, was like, okay. And then that night she texted me really, really sweet text about, how she thinks I'm strong and smart and that she was proud that I was doing something so significant with my writing. And then we've talked about it a few times. I actually, when I put it up on Facebook, and my Facebook feed is like, I mean, Twitter's one thing. My Facebook feed is like relatives and friends and horse people, 'cause we're in the horse world, and a lot of her childhood friends and their mothers and, you know. And I was like, I put it up on Facebook. I hope that's not awkward for you. And she's like, no, it's not awkward. Like, she's just very sturdy and cool.
Good.
How incredibly powerful for you to be able to say, like, this happened. It's in the past. It's contained. Like, you were able to present her something that had already been processed and dealt with and sort of put aside. I mean, that's like an incredible gift that I feel like most people just never receive.
Yeah, maybe. It probably also made sense to her a lot of the times through the years, in her teenage years, where I've been like when the Aziz Ansari thing happened and Barry Weiss wrote that article, and I was like, listen, and I like read it to her, and I was like, what do you do if you're in an uncomfortable situation? You leave, you know, and some things that have happened with friends of hers where I'm like, you're going to wrestle, not her, but like, you're going to be half naked, drunk, wrestling with a boy who likes you. That's fine. But you have to be ready to push him off of you. You know, like, I've just always kind of pushed that kind of self-determined kind of, you know, proactivity, like in terms of protecting herself. Like, go ahead and do what you're going to do, but just be ready to push back.
You mentioned in the piece that moment when Roxane Gay was on stage with Christina Hoff Sommers, which was, that has got to be the biggest train wreck of an event, traveling ideas festival that ever existed. So Roxane Gay and Christina Hoff Sommers did a couple of events in Australia, and you can imagine how it went. The audience was very much on Roxane Gay's side, but you know, there's this moment where Christina Hoff Sommers, you know, she's the factual feminist, and she's always talked about a lot of these things, and she's kind of, you know, people see her as a conservative. And Roxane Gay just does this, like, you know, well, just teach men not to rape. And it's a mic drop and the audience erupts in applause. And the whole teach men not to rape thing is so banal and meaningless and exasperating.
Yeah.
What do you make of that? How can we get past that?
Yeah, I don't know. It's crazy. Because as Christina Hoff Sommers has said, there's always going to be psychopaths.
Right.
You know, and also like, maybe you probably could teach men maybe on like, you know, Sarah Lawrence campus not to rape, but are you going to leave the Sarah Lawrence campus?
Well, also like, they are taught not to rape. People are taught not to rape and murder and steal.
Yeah. Teach murderers not to murder.
Murderers need to be taught not to murder.
Not to steal. Like, I just, I think what that, you know, it inadvertently reveals is that so much of what we're discussing when we talk about rape and sexual assault are actually cases that are not like yours. Like, they're not cases that are like unambiguously a crime.
Yeah.
And you can just then, of course, you can't teach that those rapists not to rape. Like, nothing was going to stop them. They were criminals that were going to do it.
Yeah.
But then the teachable rapes are the ones that seem like they're really just kind of a a weird event happened, you know, a weird date, an awkward encounter, and right. maybe people were drinking.
Always.
That's where that comes
99% in, right? of the time they're drinking as well, too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, I know there are like gray areas, absolutely. And there is real date rape, and there are real things that happen between people who know each other. And, but a lot of that makes me really crazy, because most rape is committed against low income women. You know, it's not the real issue is not on the college campuses, and it really is like offensive. And to me, everyone talks about cultural appropriation. To me, it's like trauma appropriation.
Totally.
Like they're appropriating like a real issue for their own benefit. And I think it's disgusting, actually.
Yeah. Now, I actually wrote about this in my book. Of course, people got mad at me. I mean, the biggest, you know, one of the biggest risk factors, first of all, one of the biggest risk factors for being raped is having been raped previously, mm-hmm. right? So there's a kind of victim. A lot of these predators can sense if somebody is a victim or if they're vulnerable. I mean, there's a whole bunch of factors here, obviously. Mm-hmm. But also, if you are a college student, statistically, you are actually much more protected from this kind of thing than if you are down the street living in an apartment in the city and working your job. And
yeah, you have to go to work at 5 o'clock in the morning. And subways
absolutely.
Are
you're so right. It is. It's like Freddie DeBoer talks about the gentrification of mental illness, right? So this is like the gentrification of sexual assault trauma or crime, or, you know, crime or being a victim of a crime.
Yeah.
You know, I've also heard people talk about how Mary Gaitskill has actually talked about that. So, you know, she had that fantastic piece in Harper's. It was in the mid 90s on not being a victim, about how she was in a precarious sexual encounter, and, you know, she had to kind of talk herself out of it, and the guy was really creepy. And then she talks about later she was raped for real, like another time down the road, like violently. And I think she says, and I've heard other women say this too, that the for real rape was less traumatic in the end than the thing that was ambiguous, because the ambiguous situation, there was a degree of self-blame and like, well, maybe I caused this, or I could have gotten out of it, or something like that. And just the cut and dry thing of like the real violent experience makes it easier to process. And I am not in any way diminishing the violent experience. Like, I think people can't even process this logic because they go, oh my God, what are you saying? But I have heard people talk about that. And I do think that people have a like unconscious guilt about their own behavior in sexual situations that they have a really hard time making sense of.
Yeah, I think that's true. I think it is definitely, it's clearer. It's also easier to avoid, you know, like it's very easy for me to not walk past dark parks, you know? So it's, and, you know, if it's a relationship or, you know, someone you know, it's definitely a lot harder. It's more complicated. Absolutely.
Do you find yourself feeling scared walking around? I mean, did it affect your own sense of safety? Did you not go out alone? Do you think about your own safety more than you would have otherwise?
I feel like I'm more rational about not only safety, but just like kind of calamity than a lot of, like, I feel like there's a little bit of a gulf between me and a lot of my friends who I feel like are very, or my family members even, like that kind of, well, bad things don't happen to people like us, you know, that sort of feeling. And I'm kind of like, well, they can actually, like, I don't feel invulnerable in that sense. And my husband, who had some trauma as a child, is the same. And I don't think it's an accident that the person I ended up with, who I met 2.5 years after the rape, is like, someone who is on the lookout for stuff to happen. Like, I feel very safe with him. I always felt really safe with him. You know, he's someone who will like see something about to happen and like, move the kid out of the way or something, move the dog out of, like, he's like, what, wow, you're going to hit the dog. You know, he's like that type. And, so yeah, I don't think that's an accident. And I didn't, one thing that I think might be related is I don't camp like, like I grew up camping and my husband doesn't camp. So that's part of it. Like if he'd wanted to camp, we probably would have camped, but I it seems a little crazy to me to like just sleep in a tent with no protection. Like that just seems weird to me.
For lots of reasons, but
yeah. Or like one in particular. Even like your kids sleeping out in the backyard, like that seems a little weird to me. Like I just, I'm not so blithe, I guess, about safety, but I don't feel like it's, you know, damaging. I just feel like I feel like I see the truth basically. And I, the first few years, I used to be really afraid of home invasion. Like I would wake up in the middle of the night, like, and be like, is the door locked? And like, and home invasion movies are like, I don't know why anybody watches home invasion movies. I think they're terrifying.
Well, speaking of that, Christine Blasey Ford's memoir just came out. And she spoke in the hearings, the Brett Kavanaugh hearings, about how she had to like install extra doors on the front doors of her house because of the repercussions from this trauma. I think that we later learn in the memoir that it's actually because they had tenants or they were remodeling their house in a certain kind of way. I'm not sure. I haven't read the book, so don't quote me there. I've been interested to see that the memoir is not being very well received all these 5 years later, or whenever, however long it's been, 6 years. And her kind of comportment around this is not as revered as it was at the time. And I wonder what you think about that.
Yeah, it seems like public opinion has changed a lot. I feel like I changed a lot over that. Like I was definitely way more sympathetic to her when it happened. Like I wasn't sure, but I was like, I was a little more undecided. And now I'm like, I don't know.
I mean, I believe her. I believe something happened. I personally think he was in a blackout and he has no idea what happened. But I mean, it's very interesting with a lot of these recounts of things, because they're talking about the aftermath of the event. They're not talking about the event itself. I mean, you saw this too with Chanel Miller, who was the girl who was, you know, supposedly assaulted by Brock Turner, the Stanford swimmer.
Oh, yeah.
And she wrote a book about this. And we don't need to get into the weeds on that case, but the book describes nothing of the actual event because she has no memory of it at all. And so the whole thing is about how terrible it's been for her afterwards. But that is a separate thing. Mm-hmm. The book itself has nothing to do with the event, but people don't seem to be able to separate that.
Yeah, I think that's an interesting issue or concept because, yeah, I totally agree with you. It's like the event is the crime is the event. But there is, I did think a lot about that, about how in the essay, I talk about how I came to sort of realize how fortunate I was in so many ways. And one of them was that I live in a time and a place where I wasn't exiled or, you know, shamed or murdered or forced to marry my rapists. You know, I mean, for so many women, being raped has meant being exiled from your community and being taken away from your possibility to have love or children or any kind of life afterwards. So maybe rape is different in that sense that, I don't know. I just was always like thinking about that the aftermath for me was, I was so fortunate.
No. So how has the response to the piece been? What's the aftermath of this publishing experience?
It's been amazing. Like I didn't get dragged. I was completely expecting to get totally dragged. And I've been like, I guess I've been saying like, I guess if you write like a really brutal account of your rape, you're kind of golden. Like no one can touch you. So I don't, because I have some
never
like,
say never.
Yeah, I know. It could still happen. But I have some real like feminist woke friends and they haven't said anything. Like there's been a silence, you know, and I suspect that they disagree, but they're not going to take me to task, you know, which they should, but whatever. But yeah, I was expecting the rape activists to come after me. And I was just expecting a lot and none of it has really panned out so far. And then I've just been like incredibly gratified and like amazed to have some people who I just absolutely admire and hold in such high regard retweeting it and complimenting it. Like that's been really like bowled me
people
over.
Like Ayaan Hirsi Ali, who your former woke self would be cringing, perhaps.
I always liked her.
But here we are. Okay.
She's kind of on a strange spectrum in that way, too, because like lots of horrible things happened to her legitimately. Yeah. I think she's just harder to dismiss than somebody who just didn't have that kind of past and background.
No, I was like, I didn't even like fantasize about that, you know. And Christina Hoff Sommers, who's I just absolutely adore. I was so thrilled when she retweeted it and said very nice things about it. Barry Weiss, Abigail Schreier. I mean, yeah, I've been like so amazed. And
Roxane Gay, have you heard from her yet?
I've not heard from her. I don't even think she's on Twitter really anymore.
Yeah. I mean, the discourse seems kind of like it's almost moot at this point, like in the sense that the problem that I'm seeing with younger people is not that, you know, they're about to assault each other, but that they're not even, you know, they're not even meeting up. They're not even dating enough. They're not even.
I know. They're not having sex enough.
They're not having sex at all. They're not having sexual relations, much less, you know, assault. But do you think that, you know, that the Me Too discourse played a role there in kind of alienating the sexes from each other a little more?
Totally. I have a 24-year-old son and he has to be so careful. Like he's come home from like a few years ago, he was working at a restaurant and he was like, I wasn't flirting with her, but she's under 18. I just like was having a conversation with her and like somebody, you know, yelled at him like she's under 18. And he was like stricken, you know, and like he couldn't even like chat with her. And I mean, yeah, I think it's they can't talk to each other. They can't flirt with each other. I think it's crazy. It's really sad. Mm-hmm. The other thing that's actually the Me Too thing that's interesting about the article is I've gotten like some amazing retweets, but men won't retweet it.
Oh,
no man will retweet.
Right, of course.
Except for one friend of mine. Mm-hmm. But yeah, there's just too dicey still. And some of them have like emailed and Claire Lehman and kind of complimented it, or they've complimented it kind of you know, off of their own feed, mm-hmm. but they will not retweet it. So
it's very suspicious.
What about on Facebook? Will they talk about it on Facebook? Men?
My Facebook corner is like so tiny, so I'm not sure.
Right. It's really just every time I go on Facebook now, I'm just amazed. I feel like, you know, it's like 2007 still. Like people are just stuck in these liberal, it's like kind of baby boomer or older Gen X people just still with the Trump derangement syndrome, having the same recycled conversations about the patriarchy. It's like, wow.
Totally.
It never dies. Like it's alive and well here on Facebook. It's like they have not been paying attention to anything. Yes, it is a time warp.
Yeah. Yeah. I know. When I put my piece up, I was like, okay, I don't really do trigger warnings, but I just, cause all I put up is like pictures of my kids and like my animals. And I was like,
right.
This is, you know, a little out of my usual Facebook feed.
Somebody on Facebook said that the reason that everybody is so much more curious about Kate Middleton, Princess Catherine's cancer than King Charles is because of misogyny, because they won't leave a woman alone with her own illness. And look how much space they give to him. It's like, he's freaking 80 years old. Like he has prostate cancer. She's a 42-year-old.
Kids.
Unknown with small children. It's like misogyny. That's immediately where you go.
Yeah. And we also don't really look at like montages of his outfits or, you know, like she's just like a little more in the public eye and like a little more connected and interesting. Yeah.
No, they just can't
get away from it. Yeah.
Yeah. Wow. Well, is there anything else you wanted to touch on, Larissa? What else is on your mind?
I don't know.
Regarding this or anything else? How did you get to be a thought criminal? Oh. What is it like for you? I mean, this is, you've had a long journey, as they say.
Oh, yeah. Well, one of the things was moving upstate has been really interesting because we, when we first moved upstate, we moved from Park Slope, Brooklyn. And we moved into this red area where everyone has like Tea Party signs on their lawns and, you know, and the SAFE Act, which is like people are really angry about this Gun Safety Act that got passed. And we went through this, at least I did. My husband was always like a little more where we ended up. But just kind of went through this conversion of kind of like realizing like, I really like the people up here. Like I always say, I don't like Trump, but I like people who like Trump. You know, they're like kind of cool. They, like, first of all, they can take a joke. You know, they don't care who you voted for. And like, I've been like, okay, well, I'm a Democrat, you know, like in conversations, and they're like, all right, they don't care. And then my friends, you know, I have friends at home who like won't do business with someone who voted for Trump, you know? Mm-hmm. So I prefer that sort of like easygoing, you know, like, okay. And I, like, yeah, it's, so that's been like really valuable and meaningful to me to realize. I remember there was that article that I don't want to say the wrong journalist, but during the Trump presidency, one of her upstate neighbors snowplowed her driveway.
That was like, Virginia Heffernan.
That's what I thought it was. Yeah. And I was so appalled by that because they do that. They're so helpful and kind. And they
have snowplows.
They have snow.
They have like, those things on the front of their trucks that plow the snow.
Yeah. And they want to help.
Put that on a Volvo.
Yeah, exactly. My son once drove off the road in a snowstorm. Like it had snowed and he drove off the road and he was like gunning it and trying to get out. And these upstate guys pulled over. Just like they're like, move over. And they're like trying to get the car out. And they ended up just picking up his car, just getting it back on the road. Like, you know, like four guys, like big burly guys. And it's like, that's what happens up here, you know, and it's lovely. And yeah. I appreciate it. And I it's just, everyone's like way more complex than you think they are. If you're just going to boil them down to who they voted for or what their lawn sign says.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we wanted to actually we saw your Twitter thread, or Megan sent it to me.
Oh yeah, you had a because we were talking about therapy earlier, and you had a thread. Yeah, we had the other day
a hangout also with our founding members yesterday, and that was actually a lot about therapy. So it was pretty interesting to see this.
Yeah, a couple therapists in the group.
We had therapists there talking about
psychiatrist and a couple other therapists. Yeah,
did they have problems with therapy?
Yes.
No, and you had I forget if it was on this podcast or on Megan, your podcast, the conservative therapist. Didn't you have a
talked about somebody like that.
Oh, yeah. A conservative. Oh, yes, that's right. Well, that was a couple of years ago. That's right, because the New York Times, this is like 2 years ago, they called me, a year and a half ago, they called me because they were doing a therapy package in the opinion section.
Yeah, right.
And they said, we want to do a interview with a conservative therapist, and we would like you to do it. We can't think of anyone else, but don't worry. We're going to find one for you. This is like such a rare bird. We don't even expect you to find this. It was like their idea, this was an oxymoron to them. Yeah. And they found this woman out in Colorado, Dee Bridge, who was amazing.
She sounded great.
Yeah.
I was like,
I know everybody wants to go to her. But the thing about it was that the New York Times, it was like, you know, an interview with a space alien or something. Like they just couldn't get their minds around it.
To play devil's advocate a little bit. I do think that to some degree they're right in identifying that there's some kind of incoherency in, you know, like a deeper ideology, deeper ideological incoherency if you are a therapist and also a conservative. Because I think conservative therapists are just like, they're priests, you know, like your local religious leader is actually, that's the equivalent. That's the conservative equivalent to like a psychotherapist or a psychoanalyst, especially, or maybe a coach, you know, like somebody very practical.
Yeah.
Somebody who teaches you martial arts, somebody like that.
That would be great. My son is in therapy and he's always like, I want them to tell me what to do.
Right.
Like, because he doesn't know what to do. And and that's why he's going to therapy, is because he doesn't know what to do. I mean, I feel like there needs to be some like little bit of coaching, at least for
a lot of YouTubers he can follow.
That's true. Yeah.
Yeah.
My daughter's actually about to go to graduate school for counseling. and I think for school counseling. And I was telling her about someone we know who dropped out of college with like less than a year to go. And she goes, she's an idiot. And I, in response, and I was like, you might be able to find a niche there with counseling, like,
yes,
you know, have that kind of response. I mean, think about if you were a teenager, do you really want a therapist who's just like affirming every single thing you say? Or wouldn't it be kind of nice to have a therapist who's like, no, that's, you need to rethink that.
Yeah. I think that's what people want. I hear that more and more, but I think that's why people are going to these like life coaches and like all these sort of niche, like ways of, you know, advice giving. It's kind of this bespoke.
You need advice. I've gone to life coaches. I love like life coaches because they tell you what to do. And then the next time they're like, did you do it?
Yeah.
Yeah. And you're like, either you did it or you're like, no. And they're like, why not? Let's examine that. And like, let's break it down. Like, and then you leave, like, I don't know. I have found like the greatest impact on my self-esteem and my sort of well-being has been accomplishments.
Right.
Like more than sort of talking. I don't know. Mm-hmm. Some people want to talk. So, you know, there's that. But some of us, that's not that helpful. I talk a lot anyway, all the time.
Yeah. So what do you think is going to happen to the world? Sorry, Sarah.
Go ahead. We'll move on.
Sarah's afraid of what's going to happen to the world.
This is the project that I'm like very obsessed with at the moment, just therapy and therapy. So we can move on though.
No. Go ahead, actually.
What was I going to say? Wouldn't you say though that in order for a therapist to get to the point of offering advice, they have to first make a judgment about you, your circumstance, why you're there, and that's the point at which, you know, the I guess ideological distinction is made, you know, in the sense that therapy as it's supposed to be conducted is not supposed to be making judgments like that, like value judgments about an individual.
Right, because that was the original point of therapy, like psychoanalysis,
right,
was just sort of like know yourself better.
Right. Like that's it. They're just supposed to help you. Yeah, guiding you into greater self-understanding, which is then supposed to lead to a kind of an empowerment now that you know yourself more. So, I mean, I
that's great, but like, what if the whole concept of therapy, I'm just floating this, is like led to more narcissism and more like navel gazing and spinning your wheels? And what if from the very beginning of therapy, there could have been more like alternatives, you know, like about other ways to find yourself? You know, you're not just going to find yourself by looking inward. And some people don't want to look inward. Some people aren't that introspective, you know.
And why is finding, okay. I mean, I don't want to find myself. I'm not an interesting subject.
Those are the happiest people on earth.
Right. Like, and like, as I said in the thread, like, what if, you know, like volunteering and like connecting with people, like those are actually, and especially now, as we know, I feel like it's very clear that we know that the lack of connecting with people is the real issue. So are we going to just keep going with therapy and like keep doing these atomized kind of self reflections and self excavations? And, or are we going to actually try to address that issue? I mean, doesn't that seem like therapy should do a switch? If the goal is like people feeling happier, then there needs to be more connection.
Yeah.
Or dancing or exercising or something, you know, there's so many things that we know make people feel better. And so why isn't therapy, and therapy's like continuing with this atomized, you know, examination of yourself. Mm-hmm. And also just the other thing that makes me crazy about therapy is like, okay, so you spent a couple sessions talking about your parents and your childhood and that's valuable. And then what are you going to do with that? You know, most of us didn't get the childhood that we would have chosen. You know, most of us could make improvements to our childhood and our relationships and as children. But so what are you going to do about that then? Like, that's kind of the question. And my experiences with therapy have been like that. It's just continuing to spin those wheels.
Yeah. And relive it. And
I don't think it's that unusual. I don't think it's like I just had really bad therapists. I think that's kind of the way a lot of it goes.
Yeah. Well, and I think sometimes the therapist is working out her own problems. I mean, so many people become therapists because they go into therapy
Oh my gosh.
And like, they get hooked on it. And yeah, like the, so then they're just projecting.
You hear that so much from students. Like I looked into this, or I started learning about psychiatry or psychology or whatever, because I want to know what's wrong with me. And it's like, okay, yeah, that's great. But now I'm alarmed thinking that you're going to end up, you know, on the other side of a desk, and I have to have a conversation.
Yeah.
With you.
And it's a real crapshoot too, because you don't really know who you're going to get. Like there, I know I have a friend who has told me about some of her therapists, and they're amazing, and she can afford really, really excellent therapists. And it's, that's not who I've gotten. You know, and she has said also that there should be like, you know, like a time frame, like that there should be like a goal and a time frame instead of this just kind of endless, which whatever, some people like to do that talking, and that's fine. But yeah, for me, it has not been helpful.
Well, before we let you go, what is your prognosis for the future? Are you depressed about things? Do you think, are you worried about your own kids? Do you think that we're just in a strange period and there's going to be a swing, a correction or an overcorrection? Or do you think we're just doomed?
I mean, I think we're a little doomed. but I think there'll be like a little bit of a correction, you know? I don't know. I mean, the AI thing, I don't know. That's scary and crazy. And I kind of avoid that discourse because it just seems too depressing and there's nothing I can do about it. I don't know. I think there's going to be some correction, like, you know, like there's like the trad wife thing, like that's a correction, but I think there might be like a little more reasonable correction. I don't know. I think we're kind of coming out of the craziness a little bit with the last few years, like the super woke stuff. Mm-hmm. Like I think people are starting to be a little bit frustrated with the nonsense of just kind of basically like in some ways letting some very young and maybe immature and maybe self-serving people sort of set these new rules that don't really work for most people. And yeah, I feel like people are kind of wanting to go back to like more reasonable, solid.
But why do you think the older people allowed themselves to be taken over by the younger people? I think it's almost like a need to be young. I think it comes from baby boomers. You know, they've always wanted to be young and hip and cool and not be the oldsters. So yeah. I think baby boomers and to some extent Gen Xers, but there's many, many more baby boomers. They just want to do what the kids are doing because they identify as the rebellious kids. Yeah. That is their calling card. Right. And so they cannot get their minds around being the adult in the room.
Yeah. I think that's totally true. I always think of, remember like in the 70s and the sitcoms, there was always like that, like record executive, like in the fringed vest, you know, like the square, right, like older guys trying to be hip and groovy. Like I feel like that's what's still going on. Like,
Yeah. I always say it's like the kind of intellectual equivalent of wearing a backwards baseball cap when you're 60 years old.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's, we definitely needed adults in the room. Again, Gen X is, I like Gen X. Like, I think Gen X is kind of like coming up from behind, you know? And
I hope.
Yeah.
I don't know. I see Gen X doing nothing and then being like, we're the good ones because we haven't gotten too woke, but y'all also haven't done anything about it, you know? Let's do something now.
No, totally. I mean, my friends who are mostly Gen X who have yelled at me for various things they're Gen X.
Well, the baby boomers won't get out of the way. That's part of the problem. There's a bottleneck.
To bring back the death panels.
What? Yes.
Obama era.
Yeah.
Talk about going back to the good old days.
Yeah. Well, this has been amazing. Thank you so much, Larissa. Congratulations on the piece. It's spectacular. Are you going to be doing more writing now? Do you want to actually tell us about your, I know you have you're a children's book author and
I do adult literacy. So I teach adults how to read. And I teach volunteers how to teach adults how to read. So, which is like amazing.
You're going to need more of those because
I know.
You just have like, you know, a new generation of people not knowing how to read. It's incredible how much literacy has declined.
It's insane. It's really horrible.
It's alarming. Deeply, deeply alarming.
Yeah. In the U.S., there's 48 million adults who read below the third grade level.
Wow.
I mean, it's crazy. And yeah, so I do that. It's really beautiful work. I love it. It fell into my lap and I am completely obsessed with it. So I'll keep doing that. I have a nonprofit, the Volunteer Literacy Project. And then, yeah, I think I'm going to, I have some more things I want to say. So probably do some more essays.
Okay. And you've written some books about a dog named Rex.
That's right. Does I write decodable books because I'm just deep in the literacy world and kids who are older who can't read that well, who are still learning how to read, they need books that are not baby books, you know. So I have this whole series. It's very popular. Rex runs off.
Yeah. My first dog was named Rex, my soul dog. So anytime I see a Rex dog,
yeah,
makes me smile. So well, we hope you write more essays. It's a really, really important contribution you've made this week with this piece. So
thank you so much. Thanks so much for having me on here.
Thank you
for coming on.
Okay.